When did South Sudan become the newest nation in the world? How did it go from fresh hope and nation building to another civil war? How did corruption affect its ability to succeed? How did Sudan's regime in the north affect its people? How did South Sudan end its civil war? And what is going on there today? How did the civil war in northern Sudan begin in 2023? And what has happened in the last year? We will answer these questions and many more in today's episode, Sudan and South Sudan 101, part 3 of 3. Welcome to Wiser World, a podcast for busy people who need a refresher on all things world. Here we explore different regions of the globe, giving you the facts and context you need to think historically about current events. I truly believe that the more we learn about the world, the more we embrace our shared humanity. I'm your host, Allie Roper. Thanks for being here.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, so glad to be back with part 3 of 3 on Sudan and South Sudan today. We are going to take these two countries from 2005, that's the end of the Second Sudanese Civil War, all the way until today, April 2024. And if you haven't listened to parts 1 and 2 yet, please go do that now because they lay all the groundwork for this episode. So many things that are happening right now have roots in the past and that context matters. So I hope you give those a listen first. Just a reminder that I designed these episodes so people who know very little to nothing about the Sudans can develop a good basic foundation. And finding information on this part of the world can be really tricky. There's low literacy rates, there's different languages, and we did our best. We often found that the nonfiction that was closest to our disposal was written by journalists and diplomats. And we also read some memoirs that were written by South Sudanese people. So as always, please do your own independent research. And if you need help finding some good places to start, I'll share some of those on my Patreon, which you can sign up for at patreon.com/wiserworldpodcast. I also share additional resources there that just help solidify what I teach here on the episodes. I give you pictures and maps and just some things that kind of help it sink in a little bit deeper. So lastly, just like with parts one and two, the history in this episode is difficult. I don't want to sanitize this horrible history. It includes heinous war crimes and assaults and sexual abuse and violence and other really challenging topics, but I also don't want this to be impossibly painful to listen to. So I have tried to thread the needle with details, giving what I feel is enough to show the intensity, including some detail, but hopefully being tactful. And I recommend that you give this a listen before you give it to teenagers. And I do not recommend it at all for children. It's heavy, but we do need to know it. You can't help something you don't know about. So we have to start with education and just take breaks if you need to while you listen. But I do hope you give it a good, thorough listen. So let's get into it. We're going to take the history from 2005 to 2024. And I would say I'm going to spend a little more of the history on South Sudan because, for one, I was able to find more material on South Sudan, and also because a lot of the major history in North Sudan during this time period has to do with its western region of Darfur, which was having a major conflict during these years. And I have decided to spend an entire episode on Darfur because just doing a couple of paragraphs really didn't work for me. You can't cover it as well as I wanted to. So don't worry, if you feel like North Sudan isn't covered adequately in this episode, between this episode and the next Darfur episode, you will have a much better look at it. So don't worry about that. We ended part 2 with the end of Sudan's second civil war. It had begun in 1983. It ended in 2005, and it was between the north and the south parts of Sudan. The north had declared Sudan an Islamic republic. The south largely rejected this. It's a lot more complicated than that, but you'll remember that's basically the gist of it. And a comprehensive peace agreement, a CPA, was signed that ended 22 long years of fighting. And there was a lot of international pressure to get this deal signed. And you'll remember that in the war, there were various groups fighting. It wasn't like there was just one army in the north and one army in the south. No, there was a national army in the north, but there were also Arab militia groups in different parts of the north. And in the south, there was a lot of violence between southerner and southerner with different tribal groups and ethnic groups that did not get along. But after 22 long, long years, there finally was a ceasefire. And probably the biggest part of the agreement was that in 6 years, the southern Sudanese people could vote on whether to become their own nation. So they had from 2005 to 2011 to more or less kind of set the stage for becoming their own nation if they wanted to become independent from northern Sudan. It was kind of like a dress rehearsal for statehood. And this period, these 6 years, is often called the interim years. And I want to talk about them for a minute because they tell us a lot about nation building. Now, spoiler alert, in 2011, South Sudan did become the newest nation in the world. But in 2005, things really weren't so sure. In fact, part of this 6-year trial period was to see if it was possible for the North and South to stay together. I mean, they just had a civil war, right? So they were thinking, okay, maybe we'll develop the South. It's been marginalized and very underdeveloped. Let's see if we can share the oil wealth. Oil was exported from Sudan for the first time in 1999. So it was a pretty new thing. And for the first time ever, the South could actually benefit from the oil in its boundaries. So the primary goal of the peace agreement was, you know, to see if they could stay together. But if not, there was kind of an opt-out clause for the South to become independent. So what this looked like, boots on the ground, was a one country, two systems model where Southerners would have some autonomy in a regional government in the South, but they also would be part of a unity government in Khartoum. And John Garang, who was the leader of the SPLM, which was the South's major political group, was named as the first vice president of Sudan and president of the regional government in the South. And he was rearing to go to create a new Sudan to bring them together. Now, during the Second Civil War and the peace process, the United States began to play a more pivotal role in South Sudan because John Garang, again, that's the leader of the South's SPLM, he gained a strong relationship with some key U.S. congressmen who led a faction that lobbied for SPLM support. And he had a very charismatic way of selling his ideas for evangelical Christians, African-American constituencies, and human rights advocacy groups. And as a result, the U.S. sided with the SPLM and overlooked a lot of his more dangerous leadership qualities. He's pretty authoritarian, because they didn't appear as terrible as the attacks coming from the north. So the U.S. supported the SPLM through aid packages and diplomatic assistance, and were also supportive of the South becoming its own nation. Only a few months after the peace agreement was signed, John Garang died in a helicopter crash. Now, this is a problem. He was the VP of Sudan and the president of that regional government in the South. So the SPLM was in a state of emergency here. When it comes to military hierarchy in the SPLA, John Garang was number one. But number two was a man named Salva Kiir. Kiir spelled K-I-I-R. Now, Salva was also ethnically Dinka, just like John Garang. I'm going to call Salva Kiir Salva in this episode, because in South Sudan, they often call their leaders by their first names. So Salva Kiir is his name. I'm going to call him Salva. A little background on him, because he is still today a major leader in South Sudan. Salva had fought in the first civil war with the Anyanya rebels and was also part of the SPLM, SPLA, when it first started under Garang. He was a capable person, took commands well, wasn't ever a threat to Garang, and therefore he rose higher in the ranks. And even when other aspiring leaders were punished or killed, Salva was so non-threatening and passive that he ended up becoming number two in the SPLM. So when Garang died, Salva took his job and became more or less an accidental and even reluctant president, and many people thought he was too weak-willed to pull it off. And just a side note here, John Garang has really been lionized in South Sudan. He has a mausoleum. He's on their money. There are statues of him in major cities. His wife, Mama Rebecca, is the country's most revered woman. But he was not universally popular. He was actually quite polarizing, and his lack of transparency alienated a lot of people. But it's really important to know he was a force of nature. There was a lot of people who very much love him, and he's a very important part of South Sudan's history. Salva Kiir, number two, on the other hand, did not have this charisma. He is known for being very indecisive and much more easily influenced by others. Many were not happy that he became the leader in this way. And this created even more divisions within the SPLM and the South, because their linchpin, John Garang, was gone. And with Salva at the head, things changed. Salva did not believe in this new Sudan like Garang, and instead wanted an independent South Sudan, which was what most Southerners wanted. Salva also didn't have any personal ties with Washington, D.C. So when Americans visited Salva Kiir, who, by the way, he always wears a black cowboy hat, these people who visited him, they realized that they were working with a very, very different person. And the SPLM wasn't squeaky clean. As we talked about in part two, John Garang had his own authoritarian leadership problems. And in 1991, at the height of the Civil War, the SPLM fractured when some of its top leaders attempted a coup against him. And when it failed, they created their own factions that ended up fighting against each other. And one of those leaders was Riek Machar, who's ethnically Nuer. And he's going to play a big role in part three, what we're talking about right now, because of this division that happened in 1991. So Salva Kiir had a huge job to do in these interim years, these 6 years. Not only did he have to work with the North on power and oil sharing, but he also had to create an autonomous regional government in the South that had warring factions, or had factions that didn't get along. And the peace agreement talked about this dream of Sudan remaining unified, but no one really believed it because Salva didn't believe it. And he immediately poured much of the budget into military rearmament. So it became pretty clear pretty quickly that the South was working to secede from the North in 2011. And this alone, unifying the South, was going to be a massive job. Unfortunately, this interim time was super dysfunctional. From everything we researched, it feels like most of this dysfunction was due to lack of leadership or dysfunctional leadership and a fractured population that disagreed on the leadership. And the lack of development within the country didn't make things easier. For example, before 2011, government leaders had to carry multiple phones with multiple carriers because calls wouldn't connect between networks. So, for example, a government minister's business card would have multiple numbers from four or five different networks, and everybody had multiple SIM cards. And getting those networks to work in huge swaths of the country was nearly impossible. So then satellite phones had to be used. And as Zach Verton writes, quote, "Unlike in the West, where cell phone numbers of the super elite are kept within tightly held circles, the numbers of the most influential government officials were not hard to come by. Their digits circulated among colleagues and subordinates, extended families and hometown communities, as well as foreign businessmen, journalists, and anyone who wanted some FaceTime. When in a pinch, asking a seasoned Bota Bota driver for the number of the deputy finance minister was worth a shot," end of quote. Whoa. Right? This makes getting anything done in South Sudan very difficult. And again, just another reminder that during the Civil War, the Second Civil War, the South had also been at war with itself, with ethnic infighting. And so the Southern leadership was not unified. And because the SPLM did not have a democratic culture, because John Garang didn't allow it, Salva had to kind of decide how to move forward. And he chose to surround himself with his friends and began creating the regional government of Sudan with hopes of independence after the 6 years. And if there's anything that I've learned in studying the world, it's that nation building is no joke. I think sometimes when you're in a stable country, it's really easy to take a stable government for granted. But the government of South Sudan has never been stable. And so the people have never known what it feels like to have regular services or have the government function properly to assist them. For example, there was no VA to help war vets recover from wartime injuries. And the central government had never provided relief or recovery or social welfare for these people. They never had a unified police force to protect them. There were no firefighters, no public schools, not even roads to drive from one town to another. Most roads were very impassable for most vehicles. So without systems and forces that they could trust, people continued to look to their own communities and their own peoples for their survival. Meanwhile, on the government front, Salva needed more support from a fractured SPLM, so he used money to do it. He included ethnically Nuer folks in the National Army. He gave government jobs to a wider variety of tribal groups than many thought he would. And a lot of this was because he needed support. Many of these deals were made by paying people a lot of money to support him, many of these people being his former rivals. However, most of the men put into governmental positions were SPLM generals or other military leaders who had little to no experience with any sort of governmental or financial training. Most were from very small villages in the bush, and anyone who spoke out against this was viewed as a dissenter or even seen as collaborating with the North. Now, if we look at this really, really logically, we can see how this would be a huge opportunity for these men to work for the government. Zach Virton writes, quote, "As in many underdeveloped economies, government jobs were most sought after. Some felt called to public service, but many were motivated by the one institution that offered a decent salary and a chance for social mobility. The top jobs, like the cabinet, executive office, governorships, all afforded luxuries of high office, jobs to dole out to loyal supporters, and huge official budgets that could be gobbled up for personal use. In a country accustomed to turbulence and changing circumstances, one would not waste a chance to get ahead during a turn at the feeding trough." End of quote. Salva also started beefing up the military. Part of the CPA agreement, that peace agreement, was that the South would get more than $1 billion of oil revenue each year, which was an incredible amount of money. So Salva bought weapons from arms dealers in Russia and Ukraine and other former Soviet states. And this was, of course, against the CPA agreement, but who is going to know? Okay, everyone knew, you guys. Everyone knew. The unity government in Khartoum also broke down pretty quickly. Neither side knew how to trust each other. And the South especially felt like the North was hogging all of the oil revenues. So there even was a moment in the middle of these six interim years where another war seemed likely. But Salva looked to foreign help to move South Sudan toward independence in 2011. The USA, Europeans, the Chinese, other African neighbors were high priorities. The USA in particular had a tricky time with Salva because he was not John Garang and did not have the same relationships or social skills that John Garang was known for. Because war with Sudan was always on the table, foreign powers overlooked a lot of the struggles that were going on between the ruling elite class of the SPLM and instead focused their attention on this referendum or this chance to become independent that was coming in 2011. But within the SPLM, the new South Sudanese leaders became drunk on their power. And with all of this oil money coming in, corruption took hold. Over the next decade, billions and billions of dollars went missing. So they were basically stolen by government leaders from the state coffers. For over two decades, these men had lived off of the bush and the local populations, and suddenly they had more petrodollars than they knew how to handle. And suddenly becoming rich was actually a major curse for the southern part of Sudan. And it's actually called a resource curse. It's a phenomenon. And with this new resource taking over 98% of the economy, the new leaders did not invest it correctly in nation building and infrastructure and the people of South Sudan or diversifying the economy by investing it in something other than oil. But instead, the leaders got greedy. And like I said, billions of dollars just went missing. It was later discovered that millions of dollars of cash were kept under the beds and in briefcases of leading officials and were sent off to neighboring countries to be kept safe. A lot of this had to do with connection to community over government and just this lack of understanding of how it should work. So for example, if you've been an SPLM general for the last two decades living in the bush, and someone comes to you and says, can you pay for, you know, my granddaughter's medical procedure or, you know, my uncle's school fees, the leaders became under pressure to deliver that money and opportunities back to their original tribes, their chiefs and their family members. As Zach Verton writes, quote, in the ensuing years, the goat herder in rural Bahr-el Ghazal remained without electricity or running water. But the army chief purchased a mansion in Melbourne, Australia, that boasted a home theater, a sauna, and two swimming pools. Like 70% of their fellow citizens, the goat herder and his wife remained illiterate, and their children had no primary school to attend. But the children of SPLM elites wore designer clothing and drove Range Rovers to premier schools in upscale London neighborhoods and leafy Nairobi suburbs. Corruption was certainly not unfamiliar in Africa, but the circumstances seemed a particularly egregious betrayal of the SPLM's history and its stated ideals. South Sudan was fortunate to enjoy ample new revenue, and the peace deal meant the long-suffering population might finally catch a break after decades of pain and sacrifice. What could explain a collective heist of this scale in a country so poor, neglected, and in need of development? End of quote. Now, how they did it was pretty simple. They stole it through various schemes. Many of these men were older and wanted to cash in before their time on Earth was up. They lived in the bush, wanted to live the high life for a while. And a lot of times the disappearance of hundreds of millions of dollars wasn't even hidden very well. For example, different governmental ministers would take official budgets and use them for personal use or give contracts for governmental work to companies that were actually registered in the names of their family members. Many senior officials would list their children or spouses or other family members, like nieces and nephews and such, as shareholders in companies for telecommunications, defense contractors, mining, road construction. For example, Salva Kiir, that's the president, his own 12-year-old son had a 25% stake in a shell company. One ministry actually withdrew $30 million and labeled it office equipment. And another authorized $50,000 for a cousin's medical treatment in another country. So this is super, super crooked, not great, not legal, and not even well concealed. As Peter Martel writes, quote, leaders lost their moral authority. It was both practical and symbolic. In thieving from the state, they stole the funds needed to build the nation. More dangerously, they showed they did not care about the concept of the country. Their parade of stolen cash offering the clearest illustration that talk of national identity was but a smokescreen for personal profit. End of quote. Because the regional government was so new, things like a central bank and things like that didn't really exist. They could have safeguarded against this extreme corruption. There's even proof that many names on government payrolls didn't actually exist and their salaries were being pocketed by higher officials. These workers were called ghost workers. Another example of this is that they ordered materials to make roads because roads were not happening in most parts of South Sudan. There were some highways, but they were too rough for most vehicles, like we talked about. So there was a plan to create a highway system and increase trade, but it never happened because officials bulldozed dirt tracks and then pocketed the rest of the money that would have paid for longer-lasting, efficient roads. So the roads obviously washed away within a few rainy seasons, but they cost $1 million per kilometer to build. So I'm going to admit right now, these are the moments in researching that made me want to scream. Like, this is the definition of corruption, and 95% of the population paid for it. In the end, during the 6 years, there was no trickle-down effects of the oil boom in South Sudan. That goat herder was still traveling 3 days by foot to the nearest market, had lost a child to malaria because they didn't have access to cheap medication. Women were still walking around trying to clean up towns from landmines that were left behind. And meanwhile, the money was relocated out of the country in foreign banks, mostly in Kenya, Uganda, the Gulf, as well as US, Canada, Europe, Australia. And many of these leaders actually spent most of their time outside of the country enjoying their spoils rather than governing. And because of this, they obviously had less interest in home. If your children are being educated elsewhere and your money's elsewhere, you stop caring about where you live. And the South Sudanese government became more authoritarian and heavy-handed. For example, they ignored primary elections and just put in their preferred candidates instead. Opposition leaders were shut up. In fact, one opposition leader spoke out against this corruption, and an army leader came to his house and knocked his front teeth out. Quote, "And so when it came time to govern, the party was ill-equipped. Democracy will not just fall from heaven," one critic claimed. "Like we'll suddenly become democratic overnight? This is our biggest problem. We never had a democratic culture. We think that the gun is everything," end of quote. Top-down hierarchical leadership was the name of the game, and not only were there factions within the SPLM that disagreed with each other, but now there's a lot of money and ammunition involved, right? In this time, Juba grew more urban and more distanced from the rural areas where the majority of South Sudanese lived. And because of the nature of the landscape, most people ended up rebuilding their huts, which are made out of straw and mud and corrugated tin, every 3 to 4 years, sometimes every season. They continued walking for water, eating maize, dried fish, beans, fruits, and ground nuts when life was good, and eating boiled grasses when it was not. Many who had left during the war had returned home hoping for a changed country, but found everything still mostly in ruins, and those who had developed skills to help were often overlooked because of the corruption. And when emergency food aid was delivered, a lot of the times SPLA fighters would take it for themselves. Over time, all of this corruption began to corrode away at a government and a people that did not have a strong foundation. And there was this big disconnect between the very small elite governing class and the masses. And under the table, true democracy was just not happening. In fact, just before the referendum in 2011, the Constitution was revised to give the president, Salva Kiir, much more power. So hopefully you're getting the picture here that the government's not stable. But despite this, South Sudan was still poised to become an independent nation. Let's take a quick break to hear from this episode's sponsors. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's becoming ever more apparent to me that every person is struggling with something challenging. We all have something, and studying world history makes that even more apparent as I learn of terrible injustices, traumas, tragedies that have happened and are currently happening in our world. It can all feel so heavy. Whether difficulties are happening to me, to someone I love, to people who live far away from me, people who lived in the past, one way I've learned to process it all is by going to therapy. I've gone off and on to therapy for many years, and it's become an even higher priority for me recently as I've had tragedies in my personal life, alongside studying pretty difficult history material. Talking it out has become critical for me. If you're thinking of starting therapy, I recommend giving BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You can get started by filling out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Therapy's taught me to be more gentle and generous with myself, with other people, and to celebrate my progress. It has also taught me that my emotional wellness is worth my time. You can prioritize your mental health with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/wiserworld today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/wiserworld. So let's talk about how South Sudan became an independent nation. The negotiations that went into this really pretty messy divorce from the North could honestly be a book of its own. I'm just going to say here that negotiating South Sudan's independence was impossibly complicated and difficult, and it was a tug of war that almost ended in actual war. A country splitting in two is really no small thing, because there are things like oil and borders and security and debt and citizenship and currency, and all of those things are pretty urgent and they need solutions. And not to mention things like making your own money or having area codes for calls. And it's just complicated. The number one issue was oil. Khartoum had felt the positive effects of oil since the 90s, but the South had really remained impoverished. And as we talked about in part one, the oil was mostly found in the borderlands, which were contested. Zach Virton writes, quote, As the two sides wrangled over contested territory, nomadic herders feared being cut off from grazing lands, while families identifying as Southerners worried they would be absorbed into the wrong country. Displaced elders clung to hopes of one day returning to traditional homelands from which they'd been wrongfully ousted. Because economic, cultural, and linguistic frontiers in these border regions were so fluid, a solution would require more than drawing a line on a map. It also necessitated creating the kind of soft border that would allow cross-boundary movement and trade, upon which millions depended to continue. Citizenship and nationality were also critical agenda items in a country as racially, ethnically, and religiously heterogeneous as Sudan. Decisions presented potentially life-altering consequences for the Dinka man who was born in Khartoum, married to a northern Sudanese woman and whose children spoke Arabic and attended schools in Khartoum suburbs. He was of southern descent, but South Sudan was as foreign a place as any to him. Would he be fired from his job or denied services in Sudan when the two countries split? Would he be forced to return home to take up citizenship in a country he'd never set foot in? Would his wife be welcomed there? End of quote. So we can see how insanely complicated this gets. They had to hammer out all of the details of the military. The North was not excited about the South seceding because it was worried that Juba was going to support some of its own rebels. The North had a cocktail of problems of its own, especially the massive conflict that was going on in the western region of Darfur, where there was a lot of violence. And because of that, it had issues with its neighboring country, Chad. In 2009, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for President Bashir for war crimes in Darfur. President Bashir is the president of Sudan. In 2010, it accused him of genocide in Darfur. His was a regime that was very restrictive. Religious minorities were persecuted and morality police enforced the rules. Sudan, you know, while not in the same situation as South Sudan, because it had a bit more development and was a bit more stable, it did have a repressive government that was not in super great shape. The North also had border disputes in oil towns with the South, too. Again, they just couldn't agree. But right before the referendum in 2011, North Sudan decides to send out an announcement that the 2 million Southerners who were living in the North would no longer have citizenship rights in the North, jobs, or benefits. They would not be allowed to buy or sell in a Khartoum market. They would not be, quote, even given a needle in the hospital, end of quote. Other leaders in the North spoke out the same way, and Southerners obviously began to worry about their safety if they lived in the North. So there's a lot of issues in this negotiation process, and it's honestly amazing it happened at all. But the Americans dispatched some of their best diplomats, and against all odds, in January of 2011, millions of South Sudanese went to vote on whether or not to secede from Sudan. And because about 70% of South Sudanese cannot read or write even today, they had to simplify the ballots. One box showed two hands clasped together, which represented unity or staying together with Sudan. And another box showed a single free hand raise, representing separation from Sudan. So to vote, a person just put their finger into purple ink and marked the box that they preferred. And the South Sudanese waited in line for hours, many of them dressed in their best clothes. It was a huge day in South Sudan, and 95% of Southerners voted for secession. Huge celebrations exploded in the streets when it was announced. They were told to mark their calendars for July 9th, 2011, when South Sudan would officially become its own nation. And Southerners from the North began pouring back into the South to hopefully build a new home there. The excitement of independence was through the roof. Hope for the future was at an all-time high. Here was a country who had over 56 years of intense violence and theoretically had a clean slate to work with. However, It really didn't. And all of the issues that had crept up in the interim period just came back to bite them in the end. The challenges of building a nation became more and more clear and painful. Quote, South Sudan was poor, landlocked, and had no formal economy to speak of. Private investment was scant, and the lack of production had created a crippling dependence on imports. 9 out of 10 people lived on less than a dollar a day. development indicators like poverty, education, health, clean water seem to reach new lows on global indexes. With no services, no roads, and no electricity, few outside the capital had any meaningful experience of the state. What few services were available were usually provided not by the government, but by international aid groups. Juba already had its hands full establishing institutions of governance in 2005. But with sovereignty in 2011 came an additional menu of responsibilities, from central banking and monetary policy to customs enforcement and foreign policy. There were plenty of practical matters, too. American diplomats helped out by putting together a How to Become a Country binder with tabs ranging from postal codes to UN membership to registering a country code for telephone numbers, end of quote. Foreign aid did pour into South Sudan, including a charity organization headed by George Clooney, who's a Hollywood actor. And I'm going to talk more about George Clooney, actually, in my episode on Darfur. The UN also did feed people, but unfortunately, much of the diplomatic support that the South had received during the interim years dried up. And as South Sudanese intellectual Jacques Madouk wrote, quote, "Our country as it stands today is a four-legged animal, but the legs are broken. Each of the legs of a functioning nation like government service delivery, a disciplined military, a vibrant civil society, and political unity were crooked. The young animal is in serious trouble." End of quote. The government of South Sudan was set up with Salva Kiir as president and Riek Machar as vice president. We know about Salva, but let's learn a little bit about Riek, because he is possibly the most polarizing figure in South Sudan, largely, again, because of his split from John Garang in 1991 and how he led the Boer massacre against the Dinka people during the Second Civil War, which we talked about in part one. He also worked for a time in Khartoum during that war when he was distanced from the SPLM. So a lot of people felt like Riek Machar was a traitor. Here's a little bit more about him. Quote, "Riek is fiery, a man whose mood and body language can change rapidly. One minute jovial, easygoing, flashing his unmistakable smile, and the next intense and confrontational, jabbing a finger in the air, moving forward in his chair and leaning in on you, a conscious imposition of his presence." End of quote. So here we have a character like Riek Machar in contrast to the power-hungry but also accidental president of Salva Kiir, who was highly influenceable and also a Dinka, right? So this is Nuer and Dinka running the country together. And right off the bat, issues with the North cropped up. Oil was the main issue. The South had 60% of the oil, but the North had all the refineries and access to the Red Sea to get it to market. China was, of course, in the middle of all of this. It operated the oil fields and it also refined almost all of the crude that was coming from both countries. But after months of squabbling about oil fees that the South was not paying, Khartoum decided to hold hundreds of millions of dollars worth of oil hostage on its own tankers to make the South pay. And the South was pretty upset by this. And so what did it do? It decided to shut down its entire oil production in retaliation to the North. Okay, so what do we know about South Sudan's economy? Pretty much all of its economy is in oil. So this is straight up financial suicide for South Sudan. It was a matter of national pride for them. They felt that if the North was going to play this way, the South was going to shut it all down. And this is kind of when the entire international community woke up to realize that South Sudan was not working the way that they hoped it was going to work. The United States was flabbergasted. Like, you're going to shut down your entire economy and risk everything to get revenge on North Sudan? And South Sudan basically was like, yeah, our people have suffered for generations, but they are prepared to suffer a little longer. That's what one leader said. So for a while there, another war looked imminent. And for a time, the South drew up plans to create their own pipelines through Ethiopia and Kenya. And they tried to take crude oil on trucks on roads that were pure mud, which ended up getting oil in the swamplands. It's a mess. The economy in the South naturally deteriorated when the prices for everything doubled and then tripled. Civilians citizens, you know, they're furious. All support dries up for South Sudan at this point. Government leaders go looking for loans, but they can't get any except from pretty shady people. And there were also major issues happening internally within the South's government, within the SPLM. For starters, in 2012, so just 1 year after they fully secede from the North, the corruption that had been going on during the interim years became more and more apparent, and it needed to be addressed. But when higher ups began saying something to others about it, the response was like, wait, you're going to call us out for stealing the money? We can rat you out for what you've stolen, too. This actually happened. President Salva sent out a letter at one point saying, you know, $4 billion is unaccounted for, guys, and you got to return the money to this particular account before a certain day. And he actually listed everyone on a public list, and it caused a major uproar and brought back all that factionalism right to the surface. In the end, nothing happened. The money was not returned. He backed down, but the rebellions started cropping up more and more. People were not used to having a government of this type. Their loyalties remained to their individual communities and tribes, and people didn't identify as South Sudanese, but rather they identified as Dinka or Nuer or Bari or Equatorian or whatever. There was no real loyalty to a country at large. There was no glue that bound them together, and they didn't have shared symbols or themes that united them. Plus, the economy was failing because of the choice that the government had made to shut down oil. And so violent spats begin cropping up between groups again, especially between Dinka and Nuer. And the Nuer in particular were growing pretty restless and feeling left behind and largely ignored by a more Dinka-heavy government. Then in 2013, just 2 years after independence, President Salva, who again is a Dinka, he's surrounded by hardliners, and again, he's very easy to influence. He decided to make major cabinet changes. He did a complete overthrow and fired pretty much all of the national ministers in the government, including Riek Machar. He also began secretly recruiting Dinkas to replace Nuers in the army. And Riek and a group of other leaders spoke openly against Salva. They began to be very bold and very clear that they did not agree with this choice that Salva had made. They also knew that elections were coming soon and they wanted to lead, right? And the in-party issues were now public knowledge. Everybody knew about them. Salva then claimed on public television that Riek had tried to launch a coup against him. Public television, there's still no evidence that there actually was a coup. But anyone who stood up against Salva and spoke out against his authoritarian nature was thrown into jail, and Riek Machar went on the run. From here, it gets out of control so fast. In December of 2013, it was ordered that Dinka members of the military guard were to disarm their Nuer counterparts, and so violence soon broke out. Dinka military men began shooting at other military men within the military compounds, and then the violence busted out into the streets. Dinka soldiers began breaking into Nuer homes in Juba, asking people if they could speak Dinka, and when they couldn't, they would shoot them or slit their throats or loot their homes. They began setting out roadblocks to check for Nuer names or the facial scarring that is done in Nuer communities. Entire Nuer neighborhoods were taken out, the people either fleeing or being killed. People began flooding to the UN compound, which did not have the ability to care for them all. But this is kind of a beautiful side note, but a Bosnian civil war survivor who had lost his family in a massacre in Bosnia actually was there and convinced UN leaders to allow people in for refuge. And this single act saved hundreds of lives. But it was complete chaos, and it became a massacre. Soldiers began dumping bodies into unmarked mass graves to conceal the scale of what was happening in Juba. Women were raped, often gang raped. Some were burned alive in their homes. Others were asked to do horrible things like drink their family members' blood or eat charred corpses in order to remain alive or not be raped. Nuer soldiers were captured and taken to prisons where their once fellow soldiers shot at them through the windows. Absolutely inhumane and deplorable behavior. And so many people lived in terror that the government troops were coming after them. And the Minister of Information dismissed everything as normal, saying that people were fleeing Juba to go home to their villages for Christmas, because this is December of 2013. All of this corruption and militarization and factionalism and estrangement from, you know, the common man, it had all caught up to South Sudan. And in 2 years after it became its own nation, South Sudan was again in a civil war. The Nuer mobilized together to seek revenge against this Dinka attack, which had been called for by the president of the nation, Salva. And Riek Machar, who again was on the run, he speaks out and he condemns what's happened and he enlists his white army, which we talked about in part two, in a series of revenge attacks. So a revenge mentality has essentially taken over South Sudan at this point. One Nuer explained that in his culture, quote, "A man has an obligation to ensure that justice is met. If my mother is killed by you, I cannot leave your mother in life. Never," end of quote. He goes on to kind of explain that he has a moral imperative to seek retribution and that there really is no exceptions. He even says, quote, "Even if it is a God who killed our people, we can go and fight with that God," end of quote. This revenge mentality causes so many problems. And the Juba attacks led to sweeping violence across the country, revenge after revenge after revenge, and then avenge what has been done. And they often barely had food or water, but they were always very well armed. And women and children faced the realities of this the most. One grandmother wrote that she ran for her life with several of her grandchildren and waded into flooded swamplands to take cover. They hid there day and night while soldiers searched the area. By 2014, the international world was starting to call it a genocide, as Nuer commanders began telling people on the radio to hunt Dinka civilians and telling them explicitly on the radio to rape Dinka women. South Sudan again became a lawless place. While the powerful Salva Kiir had initiated the fighting, everything really got derailed when it turned into an ethnic conflict rather than a political one. Gunmen stopped following any sort of military chain of command, and after some time, the violence became unmanageable for leadership to even control because this revenge mentality, you can see, it just spiraled out of control. Other ethnic groups were also forced into the fight. Salva and Riek both kind of bought up local warlords who were not loyal to either side and would give them money to fight for their side. So they basically accepted buyouts. Meanwhile, the economy is hemorrhaging from world oil prices going down and also many oil fields being destroyed. They also started borrowing against future oil and taking loans from pretty shady groups, huge debt. People who had just left the north were now fleeing back to it, believing that they would be safer there than in the south. The international world took note of this, and neighboring African nations, the United States, Norway, other UN peacemakers, they started to intervene in kind of complete panic. Uganda, however, was the one who actually joined with Salva and sent in their own troops, which also added to the messiness. Sudan in the north started playing both sides to its advantages. Kenya and Egypt and Eritrea all tried to promote peace. A group of peacemakers and negotiators were flown in and began working on peace talks to get some kind of ceasefire moving quickly. They met in Ethiopia at a very fancy hotel. This was during President Obama's term in the United States, and Secretary of State John Kerry was making personal phone calls to Salva and to Riek all the time. Washington ordered travel bans for South Sudanese leaders to not be able to leave the country if they were involved in disrupting these peace talks. For more than 2 years, the country remained in violent and economic chaos while these men, Riek and Salva, refused to work together effectively in peace negotiations. It really is a story of men wanting power and doing anything to get it. And they got very comfortable in their hotel, and in many cases, they kind of forgot what was going on back home. Sometimes one side would be so belligerent that they wouldn't even show up for talks that day. U.S. diplomat Zach Verton wrote, "It felt like a race to the bottom," end of quote. Different marginalized groups were invited to participate in these peace talks, but they were rarely listened to, ended up just going home. There was an official ceasefire, but it really wasn't heeded. The violence continued. And Salva Kiir continued to deny his part in it and even suggested that people who were fleeing to nearby Uganda were part of a conspiracy against the government. Meanwhile, the economy is hemorrhaging and normal, average South Sudanese wanted something different than this. They wanted justice and accountability and better government, not having to fear for their lives and their children's lives. They wanted schools and healthcare and food and getting a new road into their village, and they were tired. And the politicians failed to create any sort of peace, but actually church leaders throughout the country were really the only ones who managed to make any headway on the ground. In areas where it was too dangerous for foreign aid workers to go, churches offered health and education however they could. But the situation was so dire that it felt to many South Sudanese like there was no point to peace at all. As Peter Martel writes, quote, "There's already a steady process of ethnic cleansing underway in several areas of South Sudan using starvation, gang rape, and the burning of villages. Everywhere we went across this country, we heard villagers saying they were ready to shed blood and get their land back. Many told us it's already reached a point of no return." End of quote. Riak and Salva finally met in person in March 2015. They began discussing how to share people, a new government, organized security forces, and they really did pretty much blame everyone but themselves. Even the main peace negotiators wrote that in a memo. The United States came down hard on them. In the past, the U.S. had supported South Sudan pretty wholeheartedly, but that was gone. People began talking about how they could create a government where neither Salva nor Riak could be involved at all. And the questions really were pretty complex. Would that create more stability or less stability? It was high drama, high tense times. Finally, a peace agreement was signed that set up a new government where Salva and Riak would share power. Salva would get 53% of the government seats. Riak would become vice president and get 33% of the seats. The rest would be divided among other SPLM members and political parties. There would be a ceasefire, economic reforms, a new constitutional process. War crimes would be investigated. Finally, in August of 2015, the agreement was signed, but not without a lot of drama. Reading the backstory on these peace talks, honestly, it felt like watching a soap opera. I cannot overstate how difficult both sides were on this. Both sides, Riak and Salva, fled for their lives many times where the other party would kill them. And everyone at home paid the price for this. Nearly a million refugees had fled. Thousands of lives were lost. South Sudan was more polarized than ever. Many South Sudanese were very skeptical about the U.S. involvement in this peace deal. And there were a lot of theories, some would call them conspiracy theories, about the whole thing. Misinformation was rampant in South Sudan. Anti-Americanism was at a high, you know, issues about how the peace deal was made. Many people felt the Americans favored Riak or they had some ulterior motive for helping. It was so complicated, and it did not take long for the peace treaty to deteriorate. It was very fragile to begin with. And within a few months, April 2016, Riak and Salva were working out how to make this transitional government when gunfire erupted between their two forces outside, and things escalated. And by July of 2016, there was intense violence once again, displacing even more people. Riak Machar, who's the vice president, flees the country in exile, saying that Salva tried to kill him. There's some evidence of this. More violence continues, and a man-made famine was declared in February of 2017. Finally, in 2018, Salva and Riak met again, signed a new agreement, and that made Riak Machar serve as one of five vice presidents. By the end of the war in 2018, roughly 4 million were displaced, and somewhere around 400,000 people were killed in this South Sudanese civil war that lasted about 5 years. There were significant delays in the process of creating the new government, and it wasn't until 2020 that a full unity government was even formed. Today, Salva Kiir is still the president. Riak Machar is the first vice president with four other vice presidents. And violence and ethnic clashes are still occurring within the country. It remains dependent on oil. And because of its instability and lack of infrastructure, it still has a massive uphill climb out. As of 2024, elections have been delayed due to fear of violence and also an inability to completely implement the peace process that was set in 2018. South Sudan has been called a failed state, and in many ways it has failed, but it's still a nation, though a very precarious nation. Because of weak leadership, immature infrastructure, and a resource curse, South Sudan has been in a state of disarray since its independence, which I find to be a true tragedy. And moving forward, it has a lot of work to do. There are a lot of up-and-coming thinkers who would like to create change, but unfortunately, the old group is still in there, and the new thinkers are having a hard time moving in and replacing old ways of doing civil service. There are a lot of theories on how things could have been done better. South Sudan was thrust into a situation very late in the game and during a time when other nations were very far ahead of them. They didn't have clean water, but they had to figure out how to design a constitution. And nearly every single South Sudanese person has experienced trauma, including its leaders. It also had no economic engine when it started. Oil money only destabilized the nation, and it really wasn't enough to employ a lot of people. Farming was a good option, but there was no infrastructure to transport it. Power concentration in the middle was a major problem. It didn't have much to build on, and it became dependent on the international community from being in an emergency situation for so long, right? Like, food and basic services had really been provided by Western aid groups and the UN for decades, and unfortunately, that also reinforced an external dependency, and it changed the notions of sovereignty long before the country was even born. So South Sudan is a really unique look at nation building, and it's also a unique look at how tribalism and violence and trauma can affect a people for many, many years.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Meanwhile, North Sudan from 2013 to 2018 was having its own significant problems. It was, yes, playing the field in the south, you know, using the warring factions against each other to get more fees in the oil industry. But on its own ground, it was having governmental issues. It was an Islamic state, but it still had opposition parties that were being shut up for speaking out against the government. We talked about the legal code that was based in Sharia law in part two, but you'll remember that this was not accepted or appreciated by everyone. Sudan is not a homogenous nation. For example, in 2014, so 10 years ago, a woman who had a Christian mother but a Muslim father wanted to marry a Christian boy. Now, because all that matters here is the father's religion, she was considered a Muslim by law. So marrying this Christian was not recognized by Sharia law. So she was convicted of adultery and imprisoned while pregnant. She actually had to give birth with her legs shackled to the ground. She did not get out, or she did get out on appeal, and she made it to the United States. But this case shows how Sharia law played out for someone who did not fit the mold that was required. And more people began to protest, asking for democracy and new systems of governance. In 2016, because of foreign sanctions, as well as the fluctuation in oil prices, there were major price hikes on basic things like bread, which causes protests. And media coverage of these protests was banned. There were major oppositional protests to Bashir's rule, but he declared a state of emergency in early 2019 and fired or eliminated his cabinet and regional government, and many of them ended up in prison or dead. Human rights activists and opposition leaders condemned his actions, condemned the acts of his government, and there were major clashes and quite a lot of violence. Now, like I said, I'm not going to go deep into the crisis in Darfur in this episode because it's massive and it deserves its own episode. But in order to understand Sudan now in 2024, I'm just going to give you a little primer on two main military or militia groups. The first is the RSF, and the RSF stands for Rapid Support Forces. This is a powerful group that was created by Bashir's regime to repress southern rebels during the Second Civil War. We talked about these kind of Arab militiamen in part two, that they would do these scorched earth campaigns against the southerners. They caused major displacement and brutally attacked civilians. And in Darfur, in the western part of Sudan, this group was called the Janjaweed. And they were heavily used to do terrible things in Darfur. So the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, kind of grew out of that Janjaweed militia in 2013. It's Arab majority. It was armed by the government of Khartoum under Bashir. It's now a military force that is largely used for border disputes. And Bashir even used it to protect him from coups against him. They've also been deployed in other areas like Yemen to fight for Sudanese interests. But the other military group is called the SAF, and that is the Sudanese Armed Forces. And this is the National Army of Sudan. So it's a more conventional military force. It's kind of been the backbone of Sudan's political system. And the SAF, or the Sudanese Armed Forces' primary role has been to uphold domestic order and contribute to the country's development. So these two groups have had a rivalry for quite some time, and they are not aligned in values, but they both have a lot of guns. And in April of 2019, both militia groups, the SAF and the RSF, joined together to essentially launch a revolution against Bashir. This military coup ended his 30-year dictatorial rule. It was a huge deal. And they dissolved Sudan's government, announced a military council, and suspended the constitution. There were talks of Sudan transitioning into a democracy even. Then, in September of 2019, an agreement that a new government would have a 3-year power-sharing agreement between military, civilians, and protest groups under a prime minister. And in October of 2021, the SAF and the RSF orchestrated another coup that took out that prime minister, whose name was Abdullah Hamdok. Massive protests took place in Khartoum demanding civilian rule rather than military rule. And the prime minister came back briefly for a time, but then finally resigned in January of 2022 because he could not control the military groups who were at that time beating and killing protesters. Since early 2022, leaders of the SAF and the RSF have been at the helm of the government. And by the end of 2022, it looked like Sudan could have a transitional period to civilian government and national elections. But then there was a sticking point in the agreement about how the RSF and the SAF would integrate together and how these military leaders would, what role they would play in a civilian government. And these two leaders could not agree. And they began to battle each other for who would have control of the state and, of course, its oil resources. Then on April 15th of 2023, there were explosions in Khartoum that neither the SAF nor the RSF said they did. They actually blamed each other. And this rivalry escalated to war. It involved the Wagner Group. It involved the UAE, the United Arab Emirates military, and two warring military factions have now been fighting for about a year. This has displaced over 8 million people. Some people are saying close to 11 million people. They've killed at least 12,000 people, according to the UN. And most people have fled to unstable areas in South Sudan, Chad, and Ethiopia, all looking for safety because there are two major military groups fighting against each other. There have been illness outbreaks, especially cholera, that have claimed many lives. The situation is dire. Almost 50% of Sudan's population is in need of humanitarian assistance. ABC News wrote, quote, "The impact of the war has been devastating as profound damage has ravaged nearly every sector of the Northeast African nation. Many civilian homes continue to be occupied by militia groups, while civilian jewelry, cars, and other items have been looted and often smuggled into neighboring countries," end of quote. There are even some organizations, including the UN, that are saying that it is the number one crisis spot in the world in terms of human displacement and threat of drought and starvation. This war is dangerous because it affects fragile neighboring nations as well, especially South Sudan. Sudan is already in a tough neighborhood, and its descent into civil war will only worsen the prospects for peace among its neighbors. So far, peacemaking efforts have failed. And the world is watching, trying to figure out how the situation is going to go. Okay, we're going to stop here for now. Let's review briefly. In 2005, the Second Sudanese Civil War officially ended between the North and the South, and an interim period of 6 years began for South Sudan to more or less have a dress rehearsal for statehood. There are issues from the get-go. John Gring dies. Salva Kiir takes over leadership. The internal SPLM divisions grow more complicated. Despite a lot of corruption and instability, South Sudan votes to become its own nation in 2011. By 2013, it is at war again, largely between Dinka and Nuer, and other groups are roped into it as well. The war lasts for 5 years until 2018, when a peace treaty is officially signed, keeping Salva as president and making Riek Machar a top VP. The government and country of Sudan is still in turmoil and has not fully implemented the peace treaty. It is still in 2024 in a precarious position. Meanwhile, in the north, the dictatorship of Bashir leads to protests for democracy. He is ousted by a military coup in 2019 that ends his 30-year rule. A dream of democracy and civilian rule took the country. It was an exciting moment, but instead, the two militia groups of the SAF and the RSF joined together to take him out, but then began fighting over control and power in the new government. In April of 2023, the fighting became so intense that it is now displacing over 8 to 11 million people. And it's in a very fragile region of the world. And so this year, 2024, it is predicted to have one of the worst famines that the modern world has ever known. Okay, let's talk takeaways. I have about 3,000 thoughts on all of this, probably less than 5% of what we read I've included in these episodes. So I do hope one day to do an episode with my research assistant where we can talk a little bit more about the things that we've learned. But for now, I think that Sudan and South Sudan's brutal histories have really shown me the power of unstable governments on the lives of their citizens. And in turn, that has given me more appreciation for stable governments and to live under a stable government. I recognize that stability is a relative term, but we're talking about the most unstable countries in the world here, and the contrast is enormous. Albert Einstein said, quote, "Peace is not merely the absence of war, but the presence of justice or law of order," end of quote. Having a government that can provide justice and law and order is important, and I hope to be a more grateful person at the end of the day that justice, law, and order have been a stable force in my life. I know what those things look like, and I'm recognizing more and more that there are many people in the world who do not know what that looks like. And studying these wars has also caused me to think a lot about leadership and revenge. And in both countries, We have two groups right now who cannot seem to put the nation above themselves. We have leaders who do not see themselves as part of the problem, but instead distance themselves and do not own their own contributions. They blame the other side. And this has trickled down to the average person's life. I can't tell you how many interviews we read where average citizens really just repeated whatever side's leaders, you know, they belonged to. And in a country that has such low literacy rates, it really does make a leader's job so important. And a leader who can take responsibility for their actions is a really rare find these days in developed nations as well. And it's caused me to think more about what I take responsibility of, and also teaching my children to take responsibility. I've also given so much thought to why what's going on in the Sudans isn't talked about more and what can be done about that. How is it that in the last year, from April 2023 to April 2024, over 8 million people have been displaced, and it's not mainstream news? I think that the primary reason is because it doesn't have as many ripple effects in the developed world. It's mostly just affecting that particular region of the world. But does this mean that we can just turn a blind eye because it doesn't affect us economically, because it's not a major player on the world's economic stage? You know, I don't think so. I think that when humans suffer, we all feel that. And I think there's something that can be done about it. But I do think each person needs to consider what that looks like for them. I really don't feel comfortable giving wide sweeping statements or telling everyone to donate to, you know, one particular NGO or one particular nonprofit. And the reason for this is because I completed part of a master's degree in nonprofit work. And I learned that nonprofits are not all created equal. Many of them have their own corruption issues. And not always does the money actually make it to the area or the people that you hope it would make it to. Not to mention, even with great NGOs, there's often corruption in the government that is preventing that aid. So it's a very complicated web. But at this point, I do feel like the International Rescue Committee, which works with refugees in particular, is speaking out about Sudan and South Sudan. And I have learned from their resources. You can find them at rescue.org. I also have watched some interviews about the World Food Program and their work to provide food for these people, but they're struggling with decreased funding due to the economy right now. So I do not have all of the answers, but I am trying to research for myself, figure out what feels right to me on how I can help. And I hope that you'll do the same as well. I have some links to my show notes to some different ideas or some different articles that can get you going on that. I hope that you'll give them a look and see what feels right to you. Ultimately, I'm hoping that we become better leaders from this by not taking a revenge model for handling conflicts, and also hoping that we are able to approach people who think differently, look differently, have different beliefs with more grace and generosity than we did before. And if you want to learn more about the Sudans, I share some pretty great resources on my Patreon, patreon.com/wiserworldpodcast. You can also follow me on Instagram at wiserworldpodcast. You can sign up for my monthly email at wiserworldpodcast.com. You can also subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcasting app to know when another episode drops. Next month, I'm going to cover the conflict in Darfur, and that will wrap up our research on Sudan. But thank you so much for listening and learning with me. I think this is really important material and things that we need to know. And in the meantime, until next time, let's go make the world a little wiser.